there's a huge shift going on where people are moving out of cities, and it's drastically affecting the value of commercial office space, of residential apartments or condos in the city. But for your listeners in the multifamily area, it's really changing the value of these bedroom communities.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Josh Bobrowski. How are you doing today, Josh?
Hey, I'm great. How about yourself?
Awesome. I'm good. Thank you for being here today. So Josh is the co-founder and CEO of Ignitia Office, which was a premium co-working space in New York City. And this episode is going to be a little bit different because normally we talk about investing in apartment buildings, obviously, but I wanted to give some insight into the other side of things. And we're going to dive into, we'll talk about multifamily, but we're also going to talk about retail, office space, and just the macroeconomics of what's happening in our industry right now. Josh and I just want to have a very honest discussion about how COVID-19 is affecting how people work and live. And Josh has been very gracious to join me on the show today. So Josh, could you just give the listeners a little bit more about your background and kind of the story of Ignitia and how things have changed for you and your company this year?
Sure. So from my background, I've been a serial entrepreneur almost my entire life. Started my first company at 17 years old. I picked up a psychology degree and a law degree along the way. I've had a small chain of CrossFit gyms that I sold that had a really large online presence, about 65 million views on our YouTube channel. And then from that, I went on to help turn around oil and technology company, the venture capital firm invested about $40 million into. And that led to a small but successful exit. And then I moved to New York City in 2016, and my co-founder, Steven DeRosa, and myself raised one of the larger seed rounds of the United States off of a pitch deck, which was a little bit more than $5 million at the time. And our whole idea was kind of to be a premium co-working space and to bring like the highest end offering that you could bring it to a co-working space in terms of design, experience, quality, community. We were a single location co-working space, and we had about 20,000 square feet. Our best month, we were doing a little bit north of 130,000 in revenue, and we were probably doing something in the mid 30s or above profit margins on that. So it was a really solid company. However, the downside was WeWork crashed, and that was challenging for us because that was when we were in the middle of raising a subsequent round of funding, and that stopped us from raising that round. But when COVID hit in March, you know, we took about 3 months to see if we could get through to the other side or how long it would be. But objectively, myself, our investors, my co-founder, all sat down together and collectively, it was the first time that myself and my co-founder weren't able to confidently say that we believed that the product would get to a place of profitability or that expanding was the right move for investors to put capital into. And that was a really unique situation where we were very honest with investors and we just made the decision to shut the business down. I wholeheartedly believe that was the right decision. It was a large part, you know, my co-founder being really smart to do it quickly. There's a saying that if you're going to eat shit, don't nibble. And, you know, we did it quickly. From that, it was very disappointing, but also we realized very far outside of our control. And to take a look at how this kind of wraps into your listeners, there's a huge shift going on. And by the way, we are a New York City-based company where people are moving out of cities, and it's drastically affecting the value of commercial office space, of residential apartments or condos in the city. But for your listeners in the multifamily area, it's really changing the value of these bedroom communities where all of a sudden people are looking at White Plains, they're looking at Hudson, they're looking at Jersey City, and they might not be saying, I'm going to work from home into perpetuity, but they are saying, you know what, like, I don't want to go into work 5 days a week. I can go in 2 days a week. So, you know, you're seeing as of today, different reports by like Barclays, they're saying there's a 20% depression in the demand for office space in Manhattan, which is probably pretty accurate. But what I think from my perspective, that your listeners should really be thoughtful of is, how does it affect the demands of what a user wants their home to be? And when I say user, I should say a renter, because I largely believe that has shifted. You know, and you know, you can tell me because you're the expert, but I think that people have a demand for their home to serve as both a home as well as a satellite office, at least for the next 12 months. So, I mean, that would be my general thoughts on the overarching side of things. What are your thoughts?
I agree. I mean, we're seeing a mass exodus, as they're calling it, from New York City. And then all of the suburbs and surrounding areas are seeing a massive uptick in prices and sales. I just read an article recently that, you know, someone will put a house on the market and they'll have 25 offers within 48 hours. And a lot of those are just sight unseen, 20-25% above the asking price, just so they can get their families out of New York. A lot has changed when daycare is closed. Everyone started working from home, which is challenging in these very populated cities. So people want more space. You know, if they're going to work from home, they want those extra bedrooms that they can convert into offices, things like that. What's your opinion on 2 or 3 years from now? Is this the new normal, or do you think things will kind of trend back to where they were before COVID?
So I think 2 or 3 years is a really good question on a time frame. In 10 to 20 years, I'm sure the pendulum will swing back and cities will be popular again. In 2 or 3 years, I don't know. And I think that is entirely predicated on what happens with this virus in the wintertime. And not to say anything on a political side one way or another, but to look at the danger and the crime that is occurring in cities and what happens in the wintertime, and if there is civil unrest again when the election comes about, either during the election period or, you know, if there's like a change in office. And so I think if you have recurrence of civil unrest, and again, I'm not taking any political stance on this, but if people either feel less safe in their city, or factually, if the crime rate or murder rate has gone up in a city, then you're going to see a lower demand for people to live in that area. So if somebody doesn't feel comfortable with their children walking with them down the street in Manhattan, in Chicago, in LA, they're going to migrate to a place that does feel a little bit safer. And the safety is COVID related, and the safety is, to a certain extent, a product of crime or lack thereof. So I think that's going to be the biggest change. But I think without question, you're going to see an increase in these home values around the city. You know, think about it, like a $2 million condo in Manhattan is pretty small. I mean, for a family of four, like that'd be a tough fit. A $2 million home in New Jersey, really nice, right? Like, I mean, you could go Tenafly, you could go Jersey City, you could pick 10 suburbs that are pretty close to New York City and find a beautiful home with a yard. And I think those are going to be a little bit more appealing in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I agree. That's the basis of our target markets, is we want very drivable cities, you know, a lot of open space, backyards, that sort of thing. Even major cities, as long as they have that kind of suburban feel where, you know, people feel comfortable and that they can raise their families there, and less so of these super populated areas that, you know, you find everywhere in New York. You mentioned earlier kind of the struggles with office space in the city right now. And I want to talk a little bit and get your thoughts on how that is affecting multifamily. And, you know, as things change, as the economy, you know, it seemed COVID is pushing our infrastructure in a direction that it was already headed, as far as, you know, Amazon shutting down a lot of retail, people needing office space less than they used to. Will some of these pieces of real estate get converted into residential? You know, will some of the hotels that are struggling right now get converted into multifamily on a large enough scale that do you think it will also drag down the prices of apartment buildings?
My general thoughts, ironically, is probably no, because there's such a glut of apartments in New York City right now, or in these big cities, because they've been overbuilt. And you can look at the statistics. There's enormous vacancy rates on new construction right now. And New York City also has the highest vacancy rates they've ever had on a residential level as well. And so the conversion cost, yeah, it's probably cheaper to convert it to a residential place. But what people don't realize, I mean, you're still going to be spending a pretty large amount of money to capitalize the building and then to redo it into a residential complex. I think you're going to have a very large struggle in doing that and doing it in a way that ends up being profitable for your investors. What I think is more likely is you'll just have a change in ownership and a change in management when it comes to these hotels, because realistically, tourism is going to come back, and the hotel industry may be one of the few industries that's not totally overbuilt, like office space overbuilt, new construction and housing in New York City probably overbuilt at the moment by most metrics, like just looking at what's empty and the vacancy rates. One thing I'm really big on, and I'm not a multifamily investor, but I'm really big on looking at what corollaries people don't necessarily see occurring. And you know, the two or three things that I would point to right now that I tell my friends that own 1,000+ units and we talk about it with is I look at A, San Francisco versus New York, what the vacancy rate is, because many people don't realize New York is on a year lease, but in San Francisco, once you've had a lease for over a year, oftentimes you're on a month-to-month rate. So it's easier for them to vacate in a more real-time manner. The second thing I would look at for corollaries of what's actually occurring is I would look at publicly traded data on things like U-Hauls, what U-Hauls are being rented on a one-way direction. And when you see, you know, I'm just hypothesizing, if you see a 30% uptick in U-Hauls from a destination of New York City, or I'm sorry, from an inception point of New York City to a destination of Hudson, it's not, you don't need to be like a rocket scientist to understand that's occurring in real time prior to the apartments being actually vacant. And you know, I'm an example of that. I left my apartment in New York City 6 months before my lease ran out because I simply just didn't want to be in the city at the time, and it didn't make good sense for me. The other thing that I think that's important to think about when you look at long-term perspectives, and this is a bit outside the box, but a bit more just kind of looking at what's coming up, is self-driving vehicles. When self-driving vehicles, if they get on the road, the idea of like an hour and a half commute will be nothing if you can like sleep in your car, or you can do work in your car, or you can be productive on the way. So I think most signs, in my opinion, point to like these bedroom communities having more legs, whether it's remote work, whether it's a self-driving car, whether it is just that's the direction things are going. I think you'll probably see an uptick in satellite offices that are going to be popping up in these bedroom communities as well from a commercial office space standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. What are your thoughts on people kind of going back to the office? Because I mean, a lot of the metrics that we look at are, you know, major MSAs, who are the major employers there, you know, where are the jobs coming from? But as more and more people are for now working from home, and maybe even long term shifting more and more in that direction, how important is that location? You know, if people can work from wherever they want, then that throws those metrics out the window. Do you have any insight or thoughts on will that be important again in the future as far as people coming back to the office or being required by their employers to not work from home?
Well, I think the first question you have to ask, and this is a real question, is how are they going to get there, right? So if we're talking about New York City, and that's the largest metropolitan office space in the United States, there is a 90-ish percent decline in subway ridership, but the incident rate of crimes happening has actually gone up. So a lot of people I know have expressed concerns that they could contract COVID on a closed subway, or that the subways may not be as safe as they were a year ago. And so I think everything comes down to safety. And we're going into such an unknown area that I believe there are some jobs that do need to be done on site. But if there's not a real reason that your team, whether you're a group of lawyers, whether you're a group of investment bankers, needs to be in person, I think you're going to see a real struggle with companies getting people back to offices. And I think people have the ability to collaborate like never before. So what do you do if you're a company and you say, everyone go back to work, and you get a third of your people saying, no, I'm not going to come back to work? 10% say, I have a lawyer. If I get sick or I'm injured in my commute, it's no longer safe, I'm going to sue you. I mean, these are real conversations that I'm having with people at big companies, you know, that are employees of the companies. And so I think the whole thing is, how do you get there safely? And until you have a really good answer to that, the answer is probably you're not going to see a reoccupying of the city at a large level. You know, and when I say large level, I mean getting back to 90% occupancy or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. What are your thoughts on that same safety issues as far as universities and you know, classes through Zoom versus, you know, going back into the classroom?
I think universities are in such a place to be completely disrupted. It is one of the things that I am most bullish on is disruption, whether you're looking at Coursera, whether you're looking at MasterClass. You know, cost of education has outpaced inflation, and the profit margins on education are some of the highest. And I'll just give this like super quick example. I had this terrible class in undergraduate where we had to do math with a pencil and paper because the professor thought calculators were bad. And long story short, it was a big class. It was about $500 a credit hour. There were about 100 people in the class. The professor taught two semesters a year and three classes each semester. So breaking down the math, the professor was generating $900,000 in gross revenue for a business math class that had almost zero value. The reason why I state that is the absurdity of education. It used to be a barrier where colleges were, you know, the arbiters of education. They could hold the education and give it away. Now you can get the education online for free or very, very cheap. So with that, when I take a look at things and I think about them, the value that an education provides is really, and maybe not in this order, in person, having fun, partying, 4 years to kind of grow up, sow your oats, have a good time on campus. That's one thing. You know, you're going to drink at 18. No one's going to bother you. You're going to hook up with a lot of attractive individuals. You're going to have a fun time. That's like one. Number two, it is your networking with your peers, with your friends on campus, with professors, with the alumni. And number three is the education. And the problem is education itself has become a commodity. So my thoughts are, when I see Harvard Law School is charging the same rates for online classes as they were in person, it doesn't make sense to me. And like, if you went to the Super Bowl, you'd spend $5,000 a ticket. If you watched it at home, you'd watch it for free, or like $100 subscription to ESPN or whatever it is. If you went to Hamilton, you might pay $1,000 a ticket. If you streamed it on your TV, you might pay $20. There's a value to being in person. If you can't provide that value, your value proposition is objectively lower. So, I mean, I think that yes, the schools can for a year maybe charge that, but I think you're seeing so many companies coming about with alternative forms of education that it's a very short-sighted play to charge the same amount.
It's that time of the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. But Josh, since you've had so much different experience across different industries, let's leave that open to anything you want to talk about. So what is the best deal that you've done?
You know, I don't have like one singular deal that stands out. I mean, I think most of what I say is the best deal is a deal that builds a relationship into the future. And, you know, when you have a deal, a lot of people think the best deal is like, you sold something for $10 million that was only worth five. But to me, the best deals are the ones where, you know, I've got friends and professional relationships that are 10 years long or longer. And, you know, having a deal where both sides are like super happy. And I mean, like, I could point to some abstract things that are just like really good deals. Like I buy and sell web domain names, and I bought them for like, you know, $9 or $10 and sold them for like $10,000 or $20,000. You know, I mean, I would say those are good deals, or, you know, on a ROI or, you know, percentage basis, you do pretty well if you buy something for $10 and sell it for $10,000. You know, not a huge amount of money, but, you know, that's probably a pretty good deal. The worst deals, I think the worst deals are, and I've kind of done a lot of sales in a lot of different industries, when somebody is like really cheap or pinching pennies, I've just found that they'll hassle you on every step of the way and they never want to pay anything. And I just think I don't have one singular work steal. Like the first company I started was a landscaping business at 17. I just always remembered very early on, the people that were like these super hard negotiators for like the lowest landscaping price possible, it would always be like the most picky people and like the most critical and like trying to shave off the price at the end. So I've kind of found that if your gut feeling says it's not a good deal, or whether you're in real estate sales and you're a renter, or you're a landlord and you're renting, but when someone kind of gives you the vibe they're going to be super cheap, I think the best thing to do is walk away. I've seen that in my co-working space. I've owned some very, very small multifamilies that were not a big thing. I mean, maybe like 8-10 units. And I've seen that there. I mean, I've seen it in every industry. Like the worst deal is when like you take this deal where someone is just grinding you for every penny. I mean, I just always feel those are like bad deals for me.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. That's super insightful. I mean, it seems like you're a very insightful person who's taking the long view of things. And I like that your best deal is the deal that leads to a long-term relationship with someone. That makes a lot of sense to me, because that one deal could lead to 10 or 20 deals down the road. And a bad deal is someone that you don't get along with and they're constantly beating you up about price or trying to negotiate a bigger piece for themselves. And that's never fun and never ends well. So we're getting a little bit short on time, but let's just wrap it up with one final question. When it comes to real estate, let's say there's a vaccine tomorrow, where's the best place to place capital right now? What makes the most sense as far as asset class and maybe even a location, or what are your thoughts on the best place to invest in real estate, assuming that COVID goes away tomorrow?
I think you're seeing right now the unsexy markets, right? So if you're doing like multifamilies, get to know at a really granular level some Midwest city or something that is like in a Tennessee area, kind of going down into the South, because it's cool to own a big building in Manhattan, but you're going to pay a premium. You're going to get a really small cap rate on a multifamily like that, if any. But if you're willing to go into kind of like the Rust Belt, if you're willing to go into, a little bit farther south, I think that's where I'd put my money in multifamilies. And you can make an argument for, kind of a city like Detroit, where if you got to know it really well and you believe that city's going to make a resurgence, I mean, there's abilities to get like very, very good ROIs if the city trends in the right direction over the next 20 years. And, kind of that's what happened with Brooklyn, right? Like Brooklyn, they were giving away Brooklyn 35 years ago. And, even today with COVID, you're still going to pay $1 million+ for like a one bedroom in the decent areas in Brooklyn. So, I mean, that's what I would be looking at, is some of the cities that could be turned around fairly easily and what is unsexy. And you've seen it time and again, like warehouses were really unsexy and now they're cool space because Amazon's in the market. But I think like buying a warehouse is probably priced in, the value is probably, you're probably already going to be paying for the hope that Amazon buys. But like pick up some multifamilies in like the Midwest and, then looking into even some single families, buying up, a group of them, you're seeing some of the larger players start to get into that market as well in these like unsexy areas.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Josh, for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Where can others go to connect with you and kind of learn more about what you're up to?
Best place is probably on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on there. So it's just Josh Bobrowski on LinkedIn, but I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, and it's all just my name. But LinkedIn is the best spot.
Well, thanks again for sharing your insights today. I appreciate it, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.